Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What power do private contractors have to determine the course of American foreign policy and the outcome of U.S. elections? And are taxpayers getting their money's worth? Of all the private corporations that have deals to provide equipment and services to U.S. government agencies, Lockheed Martin has by far the widest reach, with nearly $40 billion worth of annual business for about 24 departments, from the Pentagon to the Postal Service. And all that revenue allows the company, in turn, to spend about $12 million a year on lobbying and campaign donations to lawmakers in the 46 states with Lockheed Martin plants in them. So what do we need to know about the corporation's impact on American life? William D. Hartung is director of the Arms and Security Policy at the Center for International at the Center for International Policy. He writes about all this in his latest book, out now in paperback, called Profits of War: Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Bill, welcome to Think.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Do you see Lockheed Martin as a sort of representative of all large military contractors, or is there something specifically about this corporation that makes it worthy of especially close scrutiny?
Well, I think it does deserve closer scrutiny, partly because of sheer size.
Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned, almost $40 billion a year in government contracts. It's about 1.5 times or more a company like Boeing, which is next on the list. So there's the issue of size, and then there's the issue of reach. Not only does it build all manner of weapon systems for the Pentagon, but it works for the Department of Energy, making nuclear warheads, works for the CIA, the National Security Agency, even the Internal Revenue Service, and helping with the census count. So I think it's kind of an all-purpose government contractor that does not only weapons production, but information technology and helps with surveillance also.
Yeah, you describe Lockheed Martin as acting in some ways like a sort of shadow government.
Well, yes. I think, you know, first of all, there's the weapons part, but as I said, it does things like fingerprints for the FBI. It's helping process our taxes. It's helping the CIA and the NSA process in some cases, private information about us. And it's also got its own foreign policy. Until recently, it owned a company called PAE, which did things like help Liberia rebuild its justice system, monitor and organize elections in Bosnia and the Ukraine, even run a private human rights monitoring group in the Sudan, help deliver the mail in the Congo. So in that sense, it does many of the things that government does, but it does it through our tax money and not with the same kind of regulations that a government agency or a government employee would have.
Let's talk about that tax money, because we certainly are all on the line for these contracts. You estimate that every tax-paying household in the country sends the IRS about $260 a year to pay our debt to Lockheed Martin.
That's right. It's almost as if we could just write the check directly to them rather than cycle it through the government. And it probably, given that at low incomes people don't pay taxes and at high incomes people often evade taxes, probably if you're in the middle of the income scheme, you might pay even more than that.
What's fascinating about Lockheed Martin is that it did not seem destined for global influence when it began in the 19-teens. Can you tell us a little bit about Lockheed's early history?
Yes. Essentially, it was two brothers who, kind of inspired by the Wright brothers in some ways, started out building aircraft in a garage, essentially. And they initially made a plane that could be used basically for joyrides or for tourists to fly over the San Francisco Bay. And they went bankrupt twice in their first two decades because there really wasn't a steady flow of contracts. They sort of missed the boom during World War One. They didn't really get a lot of contracts with the Postal Service, which was a big market at the time. And it wasn't really until the Depression and the build-up to World War II that they sort of got the company on a solid footing, at which point the brothers had essentially been bought out.
Interesting bit of trivia here, by the way. They did not initially spell their name the way we know it now.
No. It was a Scottish name, and it was Lougheed. And Alan, one of the brothers, actually said when he had his name changed, he was tired of being called Lughead. He couldn't get anybody to pronounce it properly. It's surprising he waited as long as he did, but he finally decided that that was the thing to do.
So talk about how the federal government initially, I guess mostly in World War I, began experimenting with private contracting. What was the need for that, and why couldn't these things be produced simply by government agencies?
Well, initially, you know, the innovators were in the private sector, and so the government, for things like aircraft, unlike, you know, perhaps munitions, did not have its own arsenals or its own factories. So even if it had wanted to build things on its own, it could not, although there was a practice of often underwriting the cost of some of the big factories that were needed, more so in the World War II period. So there was kind of a symbiotic relationship, but really the aircraft industry, in a way, marked the beginning of contracting with the private sector rather than using government arsenals. It was kind of a turning point. It ratcheted it up quite dramatically.
And to a certain extent, back in World War I, we made the bed that we're now lying in that companies that got those government contracts were given what are called cost-plus contracts. What does that mean?
Well, it's a good deal if you're the contractor. Yeah. Basically, it says whatever it costs you to build it, we'll give you a percentage on top of that. So without any kind of rigorous regulation, that would mean, say, if it costs you twice as much as you promised, you would make twice as much profit. So it's really almost an invitation to waste, fraud, and abuse simply because there's no penalty for cost overruns.
And I suppose it made sense at a time when we were in something of a panic to make sure that we had the appropriate equipment to succeed in the war.
Yes. I think under the, you know, the pressure of war, wanting to get things out the door, there probably wasn't as much thought of haggling with these companies about the details of the contracts. There was more concern about can we get these things built in a timely fashion?
Mm-hmm. So what was then simply called Lockheed, before it had become Lockheed Martin, was in a position to influence the kinds of weapons, the kinds of aircraft that we used in World War II and in Vietnam. Tell us a bit about that process and how the company was evolving during those years.
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the 30s, their concern was they didn't have enough influence, that they didn't have the right kind of connections in Washington. So they cultivated them very carefully. And to some degree, well, it started with they had a contract actually with the British to build bombers during the period before the U.S. joined the war. And they had to sort of get through a loophole in the Neutrality Act. They actually would build the planes on the U.S. side of the border, drag them over to Canada, and act as if they were an export from Canada. So they kind of had a nod and a wink from the Roosevelt administration to get their leg up in the business. And then, you know, starting in the 50s, really, the issue of campaign contributions of people from government who had been involved in funding these things coming to work for the company and helping them influence the government they had prior worked for, all those things started to build up really after World War II, when they were really concerned with the contracts coming down and the war winding down. How are we going to keep in business? How are we going to maintain some sort of steady flow as we had during World War II?
How does Lockheed decide where to locate their plants?
Well, at any number of points in their history, they actually, opened plants in districts of members who could have influence over funding their aircraft. So, for example, in the 60s, they had the C-5 transport, which had some of the largest cost overruns in history up to that time, had all kinds of technical problems. Eventually, they even had cracks in the wings. But Mendel Rivers, who was then head of the Armed Services Committee in the House, representative from South Carolina, both they and some of their subcontractors put plants in his district. And also, they even went so far as to, there was a bust of Rivers built in the main drag of his home city. Lockheed paid for that. So they really were looking for any possible way to kind of, influence. And really the kind of jobs and contracts issue was their kind of strong suit.
And I guess it doesn't hurt Lockheed or any other corporation in their position that in this country, once you get in Congress, you pretty much stay in Congress.
That is so often the case. I mean, there's rare exceptions like the post-Watergate reforms, the Gingrich Revolution in the 90s. But it's most other times, incumbency is a huge advantage, and it usually comes with money as well, because the contractors tend to want to curry favor with incumbents, and so they tend to throw their money much more that way than they would with some sort of challenger or insurgent.
Bill, you talked about cost overruns with the C-5, and that's not the only misfire that Lockheed has had. But they often, throughout history, have not been forced to eat the cost of these overruns in the way that we would expect a contractor living up to the conditions of a deal would have to live up to them.
Well, that's right. In the case of the C-5, there was a whistleblower, Ernie Fitzgerald, at the Air Force, and he was the one who really dug in and showed that the plane had gone up several billion dollars, almost doubling in price. The Air Force was trying to keep that under wraps. They just wanted to build the plane. They didn't want any trouble from Congress. So they actually let, in essence, Lockheed bid low, knowing that the price was going to go up over time. So there was this kind of sweetheart deal between the Air Force and the company, which made it much harder to impose any kind of discipline on them as to cost. And even now with the F-35, which is the sort of aircraft of the future for the Air Force, Navy, and also the Marines, it's about doubled per unit just since the beginning of development. So the government is trying to drive a little harder bargain. So far, the company is having to pick up about a third of the overruns. But that means it's still two-thirds by the taxpayer. So, in a commercial situation, the company would not be able to get away with that.
So are they in much jeopardy as we start to talk about shrinking the federal budget and particularly the federal, the Pentagon's budget?
Not yet. Because they've got that close to $40 billion in contracts, and because in some areas they're kind of the only game in town, for example, with the F-35, unless the Air Force and the Navy went back to prior generation planes like the F-16 and the F-18, somehow upgraded them, there's really not a great alternative. So, they make things like submarine-launched ballistic missiles, they make cluster bombs, they're building a new combat ship called the Littoral Combat Ship, literal as in near the coast, not literal as in, literally, verbally. So I think they have such a broad range that they're not in immediate trouble. If the F-35 really was up against it and came on, to cancellation or something like that, that division would be in serious trouble. But so far, it's more of an issue of maybe stretching out the purchase.
Yeah, reading through the book, okay, so they're the number one contractor to the Pentagon, and just to the Pentagon alone, they have $29 billion in annual contracts. I made myself a little chart that ultimately was pretty astonishing. They make, as you mentioned, ships, they make planes, they have a nuclear lab, they develop artillery systems, and they make warheads, missiles. The only thing they're not producing is, like, handheld guns.
Pretty much, because they also make satellites, both for military and civilian use. They even have a version of called the Joint Tactical Light Vehicle. So they're also making kinds of armored vehicles. They make, they're getting into the drone business. They made the surveillance drone that was used to keep tabs on Osama bin Laden. And it was the version that also crashed over Iran just a little while ago. So, there's very little that goes on within the Pentagon and the armed services that they don't either have a piece of or would like to have a piece of.
William D. Hartung is my guest. He's director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His new book is called Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. If you've got a question about Lockheed Martin, you can call now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is William D. Hartung. He's director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His book is out now in paperback. It's called Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Bill, that phrase, military-industrial complex, of course, takes us back to the parting words of Dwight Eisenhower's presidency. What made him suspicious of these kinds of relationships at a time when, and followed by a time when a lot of other lawmakers continued to embrace these relationships?
Well, I think Eisenhower, as a military man, was kind of offended, you know, at this notion that companies were trying to kind of distort our procurement policies and to some degree our military policy for their own gain. And he had a big fight with the bomber lobby. There was in the Air Force, and the contractors very much wanted to build a new bomber. Eisenhower didn't think it was necessary. But some of the generals were speaking out of school. In theory, the commander-in-chief sets the tone. The military people follow the lead. They're not supposed to be out there lobbying for things that the president does not want, but yet they were doing that. Also, the companies were taking out ads in not only in trade publications like Aviation Week, but even in places like the New York Times, promoting their wares. He thought this was an improper use of funds, some of which may possibly have come from the taxpayers in their own contracts. So, I think that was those were the kinds of things he was concerned about. And there was even the issue of the missile gap, where he, I think, felt betrayed by some of the people inside of the complex and the intelligence community, because there was this kind of notion that somehow we were falling well behind the Russians in ballistic missiles, when in fact, after President Kennedy took over, it ended up that was not the case. And so that kind of misleading statement or estimate was used against Richard Nixon, Eisenhower's vice president, in the 1960 campaign. So in a sense, the Democrat, John F. Kennedy, was running against Nixon from the right, and more in line with the interests of the industry.
And the industry and Lockheed Martin specifically also plays a hand in the operation of think tanks.
Yes. And, you know, I was aware of that when I started the book, but I don't think I realized the extent of it. You have think tanks like a place called the Center for Security Policy, run by a guy named Frank Gaffney, who left the Reagan administration over disagreements about arms control. He thought Reagan was going too far in deals with the Soviet Union. His shop is funded by companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Northrop Grumman, and for a long time he was kind of a full-time advocate of missile defense, which very much benefited those companies. There's a thing called the National Institute for Public Policy, which helped set the template for the Bush administration's nuclear doctrine, and there was a Lockheed Martin VP on the board of that organization. It appears that they are probably funding them as well. This is a lot of this information is closely held. There was even a Lockheed Martin VP part of the project for the New American Century, which was a network that urged the invasion of Iraq and included people like Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and so forth. So I think that the think tanks, in a way, serve as it's almost like money laundering. I mean, it's opinions that the companies want to get out there, but they feel they'll be more persuasive if it appears to be coming from an objective source rather than them saying it themselves. So there's a bit of kind of, you know, intellectual corruption, I guess you would say, in that process.
And to be clear, if we're taking you at your word that this is going on, it's not illegal. It sounds to a lot of people, I would imagine, as unethical.
Yes, it's not illegal. You know, I would like there to be a little more transparency. An expert named Lauren Thompson, who's very often quoted as an independent expert on things like the future of the aircraft industry. His organization, the Lexington Institute, is funded by contractors. He himself is a consultant to Lockheed Martin. Some journalists could do a good idea of pointing that out, so people at least have a sense of where the person's coming from, but many don't. You know, so I think we'd be better off both with respect to more information about who's funding the think tanks and also some of the experts who are sort of quoted as if they have they're completely neutral, they have no financial interest in the subject that they're talking about. But you're right, there's no illegality there. If anything, maybe things are a little too loose, that we should at least have more information required.
William D. Hartung is my guest. We're talking about his book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we find Jim on the line in Carrollton. Hello, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
You were talking about Lockheed Martin building plants in a congressman's district who was head of the Armed Services Committee. Can you tell us when that happened?
That was in the 60s. Now, there were more recent examples. The late John Murtha, who was very influential in the House in terms of steering defense contracts to different companies, they also built a plant in his district that did work related to missile defense. So it happens periodically. There comes a point where it's more difficult because you've already established your large facilities in certain parts of the country. But then, they'll think about, is there kind of a parts supplying operation or some other way that they can make their presence known in particular districts? And they certainly use this when they lobby for particular programs. They talk about some cases, well, we've got suppliers in 44 states or 46 states. Some programs, they say, 50 states. So they're very much willing to play on the location of their facilities in their pressing for higher budgets for some of their programs.
And, of course, today, Lockheed Martin, at least as of 2011, when the book initially came out in hardcover, number one campaign contributor to Daniel Inouye, who many people realize chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee.
Yes, and they also have been a very generous donor to Howard P. Buck McKeon, the House Armed Services Committee chair from Southern California, who also has major facilities of Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Boeing in his district. And he's been one of the biggest advocates for putting the brakes on any kind of notion of leveling off or reducing the Pentagon budget, even in the context of the deficit reduction debates in Washington.
Well, and again, Bill, to the extent that it's not illegal, it's pretty brilliant of them because you have bipartisan opposition to closing down any of these plants, or at least Lockheed Martin would threaten that they might have to close down if their contracts are cut or if the budgets are cut that are flowing into these contracts.
Exactly. I mean, an interesting exception to the rule was the case of the F-22 Raptor, which was a Lockheed Martin product. The most expensive fighter plane ever built was not used even in current conflicts like Afghanistan or Iraq and had performance issues. All this was raised by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates in trying to terminate the program. And he was actually able to get that done despite Lockheed Martin's spread of contracts around the country. I think partly because the administration pushed very hard. The president threatened to veto any defense bill that included the F-22. Some of the deficit hawks and Tea Party members didn't really see a strategic need for this. They saw this as a chance to save some money. So there are cases where even that notion of having plants everywhere and the jobs issue and so forth don't carry the day. But a lot of times you need very heavy influence on the other side. I mean, the fact that the president, the Secretary of Defense, were so committed to this, sort of was a more or less a split in the military-industrial complex. The military really was on one side, and industry was on the other.
What sort of back-and-forth mobility is there between the upper echelons of Lockheed Martin and the upper echelons of the Pentagon and high federal office?
Well, the industry as a whole, it's quite amazing. They have now 1,000 lobbyists, of which more or less two for every member of Congress. And about two-thirds of those come from, they either worked for key members of Congress or the Pentagon, or they worked in the Department of Energy on nuclear warhead-related issues. So you have the general phenomenon. And then in Lockheed Martin's case, you also have had the reverse, where they have executives that go from Lockheed Martin into key positions in government. So in the Bush years, for example, the head of the nuclear warhead complex came from Lockheed Martin. The chief of procurement of military space equipment came from Lockheed Martin, the deputy director of the National Security Council, the person who was in charge of Latin American affairs at the State Department, who also prior had been a lobbyist for Lockheed Martin trying to sell their F-16 fighter planes to Chile, the head of procurement at the Homeland Security Department. So there are a whole series of examples, and it's actually hard to get the full sense of it because although people are supposed to report on where they're going when they leave government, these reports are now somewhere deep in the Pentagon. It's very hard to get them to actually make them public, as was the case that used to happen, say, 20 years ago or so.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we go to Gainesville. We have Herschel speaking with us out there. Hi, Herschel.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Sure.
Your guest made a comment earlier about cost-plus contracting in government, and it may have left a negative impression with your listeners. There is cost-plus contracting with the government, but the cost, the fees are never calculated as a percentage of cost. That's illegal. So there is cost-plus contracting, but there's no incentive to run up the cost. Your fees calculated on some incentive formula based on your savings, actually. It could be a fixed fee. It could be a zero fee. But I had the impression from, it wasn't mentioned, that the cost plus a percentage of cost contract is illegal.
Well, Herschel, I appreciate your perspective a lot. To be clear, we were actually talking about what was taking place during the First World War and not what's happening now. But did you want to comment on that, Bill?
That's an excellent point. I mean, there's all kinds of complicated arrangements, cost plus incentive fee, different awards based on performance. But a lot of times in the execution of these contracts, there's still a heavy bias towards the companies. Secretary of Defense Gates made, quite a bit of splash when he actually, on the F-35, withheld and delayed an award fee of $614 million because Lockheed Martin was not meeting its performance and cost specs on that. But that money eventually did go to them, even though there's ongoing problems with the aircraft. So I think it's true that there's some complexities now that didn't exist in the old days. But I think it sort of comes down to, are those things enforced adequately? And, especially in the current buildup, there's actually been a reduction of Pentagon auditors at the same time that in dollar terms, depending on budget, has almost doubled. So I think a lot of it comes, the devil's in the details. And I think we really need more information than we're getting now to get a sense of whether some of these accountability measures are really being taken seriously.
We have an email here from Dean in Wiley who asks, what was Lockheed Martin's role in the Cold War, and are they selling to Russia or Afghanistan today?
Well, in the Cold War, they were sort of right in the middle of it. Not only did they make war material for the Korean War, but their then leader actually was giving speeches talking about how, air power was the wave of the future. It was the only way for the United States to have a global role, to be kind of the kind of bulwark of freedom versus communism, and that the only way to do that, to have that global reach, would be to buy transport planes, which happened to be built by Lockheed. So there was kind of a, almost a pitch being made. But then also they did things like build the U-2 spy plane, which was a very useful tool in keeping track of what the Soviet Union was doing, particularly in the 50s and 60s. And they were in on the ground floor of things like ballistic missiles and, nuclear submarines and so forth. So both as a weapons supplier and as a kind of player in the political and strategic discussion, they were among the most important companies, during the entire Cold War period. In terms of sales, they've never sold directly to Russia or the Soviet Union, although there's some talk of cooperation and things like satellites, so nothing directly military. For Afghanistan, they supply our forces with all manner of equipment, be it combat aircraft, be it the surveillance drones that I mentioned earlier. There's machines, missiles that spray cluster bombs over, certain areas of a battlefield. So that, it's hard to get contracts broken down by how many are for Afghanistan versus Iraq versus the Pentagon's general purchasing. But just based on the number of their systems that are present, on the war front in Afghanistan, I would say they're probably among the larger beneficiaries of the war effort.
I did not realize, Bill, until I read this book, that Lockheed played a role in anything like recruitment or interrogator training for some of the offshore prisons that the U.S. Military now maintains.
They bought a couple companies. Affiliated Computer Services was one, another called Cytex, which were had private interrogators at places like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. They since have sold those elements to the company, and they assert that they're no longer involved in it. So it seems like the main period was probably 2003 or so through 2007, 2008. Nobody said this to me explicitly, but I have a feeling that the company, part of their rationale was that this was not particularly good for their reputation relative to the amount of money that could be made, you know, carrying out that activity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Rick in Fort Worth. Hi, Rick.
Hello. I'm curious, is there a plan for, like, a documentary that can better illustrate for the, you know, typical American how this web of deceit really works? You know, this merchandising apparatus that just kind of siphons money out up to the top of these, you know, rich military industrial complex guys.
Bill, a documentary for those who don't feel like reading the book?
I would love that. in fact, I probably wouldn't have written the book if there was a good documentary. There is a piece that was done a few years ago by a director, Eugene Jarecki, called Why We Fight, which had some of this kind of information. There's also a director in Hollywood now, a documentary filmmaker named Robert Greenwald, who's made films about things like the influence of the Koch brothers over our politics. And he's been talking about doing a film either on the military-industrial complex, broadly speaking, or maybe even on Lockheed Martin. And he's made some short videos, sort of teasers for the web that would be the kind of thing that he might go into in more depth if he does the documentary. So there's things in the works. You know, the trick will be if he does it, how broadly will it be distributed? His Koch brothers film, he actually kind of did more of a grassroots effort than trying to get it into major theaters. But I think it's absolutely true. Sometimes that that way of telling the story has a lot more impact than reading a book. I realize it's sort of
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is William D. Hartung. His book is called Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is William D. Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and author of the book Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. It's available now in paperback. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Bill, the contracts that Lockheed has with governments outside the United States, do those put jobs in American cities?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the argument for building some of these things is about jobs in the United States. But something like the F-35, there's 9 partner nations. Australia and the United Kingdom and Turkey and others, and also purchasers like Israel and Japan. Each of those countries is going to get a piece of the production on the F-35, not only producing the parts for the ones that they're buying, but for every F-35 that's built. So you reach a point where some of this global outsourcing cuts into that notion of jobs here. You know, you probably at some point you'll get, you know, half as many jobs per amount spent just because of the kind of global production scheme that's being put together. So it's kind of interesting because when Lockheed Martin is in Italy, they talk about how great it's going to be for Italy and jobs in Italy. When they're in Turkey, it's about jobs in Turkey. And, of course, when they're here, it's about jobs in the United States. So, it's, you know, the same job can't be in 3 places. So there is kind of a, you know, the spread, which is changing the impact of Pentagon spending on our own economy.
We have an email here from Mellon in Dallas who writes, I was told Lockheed is taking over administrative functions from state agencies like the Texas Workforce Commission. And in fact, they do a lot that might surprise people.
Well, there was a point where they actually wanted to run sort of the entire welfare intake process in the state of Texas, not only welfare itself, but food stamps and Medicaid, the full range of sort of income-based programs. And that larger scheme fell apart, in part because they were bidding against EDS, a Ross Perot's old company, partly because the union that represented the workers in that sector was very much opposed. They even did ads where they did things like you'd have the sound of a flushing toilet, and they'd say, you know, the company that built the $700 toilet seat now wants to run public services in the state of Texas. So they sort of played on the company's old cost overrun issues and corruption issues to try to say to people, do you really want this to be the company that's running important services in your state? Now, their information technology unit is still trying to get as many contracts as possible at the state and local level. So it's possible that they have some diminished role in things like the Texas Workforce Commission, but it's not sort of the big, fat contract to run everything that they had hoped to get.
What do they do for the Postal Service?
Well, it's mostly processing information. They make scanners that can read packages so that they don't have to be done by hand, things like that. I mean, a lot of these things, if they work properly, are, perfectly useful. The problem is there's been a lot of breakdowns. For example, they were supposed to make cameras for the New York City subway system, and that contract was revoked because of cost overruns and their inability to actually get those cameras in place in a timely way. They had problems with processing claims from the Veterans Administration and others. So it's really, to some degree, I think they probably have to be judged case by case, but they have had some difficult issues on the information technology processing side of the operation.
So, Bill, certainly this is a free market economy. What are the impediments to a smaller company or an upstart or some sort of competitor coming in and snatching away business that is costing too much to be provided by Lockheed Martin?
Well, I think part of the problem is a lot of the contracts are let in such large pieces. So it's a big company has an advantage. They're sort of almost like the general contractor when you're building a house. They get the bid, and then they dole out the contracts to the smaller companies. There might be a system where if the government played a little more active role in that supervision, they could, give a contract to some of the smaller companies directly, and they then would get perhaps more opportunities than they get now. But the system is fairly ingrained, and along with the lobbying power of some of the big companies, I think it would take a lot of, a major push to get that bidding system change in a way that would make it easier for smaller companies.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Andre in Grand Prairie. Hi, Andre.
Hello, Chris. You're amazing. Bill, I love what I'm hearing from you, but I just have a very light question. With this information in your book, are you for, against, or neutral to Lockheed?
I would say I'm against the current arrangements of how they get their contracts and how they perform some of them. I think it's kind of an issue of checks and balances, which is what Eisenhower was talking about in his military-industrial complex speech. If you've got a company that's this big, that gets this much government money, that can turn around and use some of it to influence the government, I think you run into problems. I think if we had smaller, more competitive firms, we would get a better deal for the taxpayer. But, I would say when they do something well, they should be given credit for it. I mean, they've worked on the census. The census came in under budget in the most recent round and appears to have worked reasonably well. So, as I mentioned before, I think in some instances you sort of have to look case by case. But I think we'd be better off if one company didn't have that kind of concentrated power that it has now.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go up to Frisco next and speak with Rick. Hi, Rick.
Hi. If I understand things correctly, Lockheed Martin has an employee-funded super PAC that's quite influential, and it's not just the CEO and the CFO. It's thousands of employees contributing to it. How influential are they, and is that typical for big defense contractors, or does Lockheed Martin have a particularly strong super PAC?
Their PAC is larger than the other companies in the industry. However, it's not as large as you know, some of the packs of industries like finance, insurance, and real estate. So it's, I think where they have the edge is they're so good at targeting. You know, so we mentioned they're the main contributor to Daniel Inouye, who runs the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, and to Buck McKeon, who runs the House Armed Services Committee, and to members who, where they've got some sort of presence economically, they're trying to sort of give an extra boost to that by also giving large contributions. And it's to both parties, you know, depending on, you know, who they think they can influence at the moment. So, you know, I would say that they're in the game. They're not as big as some other industries. And even some of the individuals who are writing these huge checks, you know, sort of under their own impetus, may have a bigger influence on things like the presidential campaign. Lockheed Martin mostly focuses on congressional races.
What do we know about how profitable Lockheed Martin is?
Well, they, you know, it appears that they probably make in the range of 8, 10, 12% profit, which, given that a lot of their, some of their equipment and a lot of their contracts, their main customer is the government, they don't really have a lot of competition. They're doing pretty well for themselves. You know, I think until recently, with the leveling off of Pentagon budget, they were a very hot item on Wall Street. Now Wall Street is sort of stepping back and saying, well, where is this going with the budget? And are they going to be, are they going to sort of level off or take a hit, or are they going to continue to grow the way they did during the buildup that started really in 2000 or so?
It does seem like their diversification into non-military industries and applications would put them in a good position, even if somehow we decided we were the world's greatest pacifist nation. They've still got their fingers in a lot of pies.
That's right. I mean, some of these other activities are not as well funded, but that's because the Pentagon takes up about 56 cents out of a dollar of our discretionary budget. But were there to be a shift, you know, towards more domestic investment, they'd be right there, you know, ready to get contracts. And even things like, you know, they've been involved in building, you know, camps for peacekeepers. And so even in the issue of conflict, sometimes they're on both sides of the divide, both the supplying the wars and helping with the rebuilding after the wars.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Marshall in Dallas. Hey, Marshall.
Hi. Yes, I seem to remember when Lockheed, 9 or 10 years before Chrysler, got bailed out to the tune of $500 million by the U.S. government. I believe it was back in 1970. It was a very close vote in the Senate. I think it was only carried by one vote. And the second point I'd like to make is about Ernest Fitzgerald. He was actually not a colonel, but rather the highest GSA rated civilian in the Department of Defense. And he actually gave the credit for the tagging of the C-5A overruns in his book, The High Priests of Waste, to a Air Force captain. And Fitzgerald's treatment by the Pentagon was nothing less than the criminal. Any comments about those two?
Thanks for your call, Marshall.
Those are good points. You know, the bailout vote, as you referenced, it came down to one vote in the Senate. And what happened was there was a senator from Montana who was going to vote against the bailout. And Senator Alan Cranston, a liberal from California, who had a lot of Lockheed presence in his state, came over to him and said, do you want to be responsible for putting tens of thousands of people out of work? And so he brought that senator around, who was the final vote. You're right, Fitzgerald was not the only player in the mix in terms of exposing the overruns. And he ultimately lost his job as a result. For a while, he worked for William Proxmire's committee. Proxmire was a big opponent of the bailout and also one of the people who helped publicize the cost overruns on the C-5. But he had a tough time of it for many years. He eventually was reinstated at the Pentagon after he filed the suit against them. But they never really gave him the same kind of responsibilities he had before. So he was sort of doing the equivalent of hanging out by the Xerox machine instead of really putting his teeth into some of these programs and seeing where the waste was. So, you know, I think he was quite courageous to do what he did, and I think he would, if asked to do it again, he certainly would. But he paid a price for it, no question.
Did you have any official response from Lockheed once the book was officially published last year?
It was minimal. You know, they didn't want to cooperate with the research for the book. Mm-hmm. They sort of kept closing the door on that. I had some pre-existing interviews and material. They gave kind of a blanket statement to a reporter from Politico saying, well, he should have contacted us, which, of course, I did. And there's a lot of misrepresentations there, but they never said what they thought they were. So there was never an effort to really have a debate or a back and forth about the factual content of the book.
So if the ultimate argument here is that we need more transparency, more accountability, talk about some ways that we could make this happen.
Well, I think, you know, the revolving door, for example, I think it should be made very clear where a person came from in government, where they're going in industry. They should be prohibited from lobbying their former, you know, branch of the government for, I would say, 5 years or more after they leave government. I think on the contributions to think tanks, that should be right up front and center instead of kind of hidden, you know, in the book somewhere and not really disclosed to the public. I think there needs to be some way of breaking up the contracts so they can be competition, so the big companies don't have unfair advantage and can kind of be unaccountable by virtue of the fact that the government has nobody else to turn to for some of these big systems. I think, you know, we need some version of campaign finance reform, but I think that applies not just to, you know, companies like Lockheed Martin, but across the board. So I think those are the kind of things. It would be also useful if we had more investigative journalism about this kind of thing. And there were a lot of good pieces, you know, by working journalists that helped me with the book, but I think if there were more attention devoted to that, if reporters were given more time to look into these kinds of things, I think it would help us have a more informed discussion about, you know, the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower, you know, identified.
As it stands now, you see a pretty rosy future for Lockheed Martin?
Well, I think it's interesting. They've had their moments. You know, there were the bankruptcies in the early years. There was the bailout in 1970. But I think unless we see substantial cuts in the Pentagon budget, which are not currently on the table, President Obama has kind of slowed the rate of growth, and he's leveled it off, but it's at quite high levels by historical standards. So I think unless we saw a substantial dip in things like spending for the Air Force and the Pentagon generally, they'll be fine. You know, they may not be growing at the tremendous rates they were when there was endless, seemingly endless growth in Pentagon spending, but they'll be a good, solid company that's, you know, making money and employing large numbers of people.
William D. Hartung's latest book is out now in paperback. It's called Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about the show and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.